days where God just obliterates the earth. All of the water is turned into blood. The sun has been scorching people with heat. And by the way, if you think the last few weeks have been warm and setting record temperatures, ignore that. There's going to be a new record set come the end times. Did anybody see Ken Ham's answer to that, by the way? I think he just sent out an update email. Gary, did you get that one at all? Wait, you don't get email. You have to wait for the paper copy, don't you? Yeah. So it's really good. I went to their website. Here's a rabbit trail. I went to their website this morning because I usually on Sunday morning I try to check up on a few of the things they're doing. But I typed in answersingenesis.org and I hit enter, and it pops up this plain white page that says nothing to see here. And I said, that doesn't seem right. So I loaded one of their emails that they had sent me, and I clicked on a link there to a specific article, and it brought it up. And at the top of that page is a link back to their homepage. So I clicked on that link, and it goes back to little white page, nothing to see here. I said, did they get hacked or something? I wonder if somebody got in and changed their routing or something, but I don't know. Kim went down on her computer and tried it. Same thing. We called Hannah. Because she knows Ken Ham personally now, working there. No, she doesn't. But she tried it on her phone, and she says, oh, no, it's working. And so we tried it on a phone, and on phones it was working. On the desktops, it wasn't. And I don't know if you guys realize, but when you design a website, you have to design two of them, one that's designed for phones and one that's designed for desktops. And my guess was, I don't know, if somebody hacked their site and redirected it temporarily, but it's all back in working order, and I know that makes you, you know, feel less stressed about it. So I should really get off of rabbit trails while we have. Okay, so Revelation chapter 16, the rapid outpouring of God's wrath is the final judgments are like a pre-invasion bombardment of the earth. All of the water has been turned to blood. The sun is scorching people with heat. All of the people that worshipped the beast by receiving a mark upon their right hand or upon their forehead have had grievous sores erupt upon their body. Darkness that can be felt and it caused great pain was implemented upon the world. And then God dried up the river Euphrates so that the earth could finally pull together all of its armies in one place for one last stand against Christ's return. It's the ultimate expression of Psalm chapter 2, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us cast off their bonds from us. The world does not want God ruling over it. Right now, we see that in limited ways. And I know we watch society around us, so it's like, boy, they're casting off God's cords everywhere. They're trying. This is still a limited and restrained expression of that rebellion. And in the final moments of the seven-year tribulation, every ounce of rebellion will be pooled together. God has pulled his hands back completely and allowed the earth and all of its inhabitants to fully express their sinful rebellion. That in itself is going to be part of the terror of the tribulation period. But now that that has all been prepared, the seventh bowl was poured out, and we heard a great voice say, it is finished, or it's done. It's been accomplished. God's purpose for world history is finished. And a great earthquake flattened the earth. It says, every island fled away, and every mountain fell. So that God has quite literally leveled out the surface of the earth. We looked into some other passages in prophetic scripture that talked about the only exception to that is going to be Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to be lifted up. It will be the highest point on the earth during that period because God has a purpose for that city. It'll serve as the capital of his kingdom. Christ has not yet returned in our narrative. The seventh bowl was poured out. The earth is totally ready for Christ to return and conquer it. But right as we saw that happen, God sort of went to a commercial break. Or he's going to pull back and show us something else that we need to understand before Christ, before we see Christ return. Okay? And that's Revelation 17. Revelation 17, 18, and 19 are another parenthesis in the narrative. And so we're going to see this vision of a great prostitute and a beast, or as I title it here, a monstrous woman and a beastly monster. So, chapter 17, verse 1, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me, and he said, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk from the wine of her fornication,'" or sexual immorality, some of your translations will say. John is, he's amazed here at first, because this angel comes and talks to him. And it's interesting, he uses an emphatic form of the word "me" in the original Greek. He says, "An angel, one of the angels who had the seven bowls came and he spoke to me." Like, John's just amazed that this angel, so mighty in power and so authoritative, would come and speak to him. And I think that's going to come to play a little bit later. John's going to have an issue because he's going to try to bow down and worship this angel. And he's going to get a very stern rebuke for it as well. But I think that's part of the amazement here, is that these angels are powerful. These angels are glorious. And it leaves this impression on John. He came and he's talked to me. And what he told John was, "I'm going to show you the judgment of the great harlot, the great prostitute, who is seated upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication." Now, if you jump back to chapter 14, verse 8, real quickly, we're going to look at a couple of verses here. Chapter 14, verse 8 is one of the first references in the book of Revelation to Babylon the Great, or this great harlot. Where'd it go? Verse 8, chapter 14. "Another angel, a second, followed, saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all the nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality.'" That's one of the first references in the book of Revelation to this concept. Chapter 17 is going to explain it. What are we talking about when we reference Babylon the Great? What's being described there? So that angel tells us that Babylon is going to be fallen, and he introduces the idea that all of the nations have joined with her in this immorality. Jump ahead a few verses to chapter 16, verse 19. "The great city was split into three parts." This is the seventh bowl judgment, by the way. "The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath." And so there's another reference to Babylon the Great. And so now the angel says, "Come, I'm going to tell you about Babylon the Great. I'm going to show you what this means." One of our standards as we've been studying the book of Revelation is to understand that most of the time in the book of Revelation, when there's an image that's kind of strange, God interprets it for us. We're not left to try to wonder or use our imagination to figure out what he's talking about. He explains it. And we've seen this time and time again throughout Revelation with all the strange imagery that is presented. And so that concept of Babylon the Great that has been mentioned twice, now we're going to see what it means. And so if we were going to read Revelation again, we could take this interpretation that's given to us in chapter 17 and go back and reread with a better understanding. By the way, that's one of the best benefits of a regular pattern of Bible reading. Is, you know, the first time you read the Bible, you're not going to understand all of it. The second time you read your Bible, you're not going to understand all of it. The 100th time you read your Bible, you're not going to understand all of it, but you're going to understand it better the 100th time than you did the first time, right? When I first became a Christian, I was 14 years old, and I just started reading. I was so hungry to learn what God had said in the pages of the Bible, and I read it. I think I read through it three times that first year. I had a lot of spare time as a young man. I don't read through it quite that quickly anymore. But, you know, the first time I read through it, there was an awful lot that I just say, I have no clue what that is talking about. But every time you read it, you start filling in gaps. And that's the benefit of just a continual pattern of reading your Bible. So just encourage you along that Don't be afraid if there's things you don't understand. Just keep reading. Next time you get through, you might understand it better. It might be five times down the line here that you understand it better, but keep reading. Babylon, of course, historically speaking, was a real city. It comes up a couple of times in biblical history. The first time, way back in Genesis, very shortly after the flood, it's where all of mankind had stayed put. They stayed together at Babel, which, of course, Babel is part of the formation of the word Babylon. They're very, very similar words. They built a tower there to defy God's command to spread out and cover the earth. And they specifically said, let's build a tower so that we can make a name for ourselves. Let's reach up to heaven. They wanted to stay put where God had told them, spread out. Fill the earth. Subdue it. And they said, no, we won't all stay together. So it's sort of mankind's first collaborative group effort. And it was in defiance and rebellion against God's commands. And so they started building the tower, and in order to stop that, God came down and confused their languages. That's why today we use the word Babel to reference somebody that's speaking nonsense, because the languages were all confused and nobody could understand each other. We still have a hard time today because the effect of the Tower of Babel, God is still using it to stop mankind from cohesively working on any one thing. We're getting close to trying to eliminate the effects of Babel through artificial intelligence, trying to get computers to be able to translate languages for us. Our AI is the new Tower of Babel. I'm pretty convinced of this. If you disagree with me on that, that's fine. Maybe you think space exploration is the new Babel. You're probably right, too. I don't think there's really going to be one new Babel. Just the question for me is whether God throws another rock at us to scatter and confuse us, or if he lets us unite again for some kind of rebellion like that. But later in history, Babylon became a great empire in the world, and God used that nation to discipline his people Israel. They were kicked out of the land of promise because they refused to obey the terms of the covenant. And they were disciplined by God by being exiled to Babylon for 70 years. And in that nation of Babylon, they were subjected to slavery. They were subjected to living in the midst of a wicked people. The Babylonians were culturally advanced. They were wealthy, but they were wicked. And so the Jewish people, having to live there, maintained a sort of a group memory about Babylon well into the future. So even when John is writing this and he mentions the word Babylon, every Jewish reader would have drawn up from the collective memory the idea of the exile living in Babylon. And so they would have pulled together some of this idea that, well, Babylon represents exile. Babylon represents wickedness. Babylon represents idolatry. You know, we read the stories of Daniel and his friends having to deal with the rampant idolatry that existed in Babylon and how they were supposed to live in that multi-religious culture, pluralistic society. So they determined not to eat food that had been offered to idols. They determined not to eat unclean foods. And that one worked out okay for them. But then they determined, we're not going to worship these false gods either. And they were thrown into a fiery furnace because of it. Babylon is that picture of idolatry because Babel is where the idolatry of mankind began. Way back at the tower, it continued through to the Babylonian Empire in the 600s and the 500s BC. And so that's part of what's going on here. The concept of Babylon the Great pulls together those ideas. So then the angel invites John and says, come, I'm going to explain to you everything about this woman, Babylon the Great. And he mentions to us one of the concepts, or a couple of the concepts that he's going to show us, her judgment. You know, he says, I'm going to show you the judgment of the great prostitute, which we've just read a little bit about, by the way. All of the judgments of Revelation, as we saw back in chapter 14 and chapter 16, are judgments on Babylon the Great, Babylon the Mystery. Okay, so she's going to be judged. She sits on many waters. What's that picture all about? He'll explain that concept. And with whom the kings of the earth have committed an immorality. He'll explain that too. What does that mean? What's this picture? And with whom the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on the earth have become drunk. Drunkenness is a theme that has come up a couple of times in the book of Revelation, and so he's going to apply that to this as well. So verse 3 begins the actual vision of it, and then we'll see the interpretation. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. That's the beast, by the way. The beast has blasphemous names and has 7 heads and 10 horns. Should conjure up, for those of you that have been with us throughout this study, should conjure up scenes because we've been introduced to this beast before. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls. So what does that tell you about the woman? She's wealthy. She's comfortable. She's living in luxury. Okay. Hang on to that one too. The gold and the purple and the scarlet are royal colors. This woman rules. She's in control of things. She's holding in her hand a cup full of abominations and the impurities of her immorality. So she's got this cup in her hand that's just full of ick, full of evil, full of vileness, full of wickedness. What's she doing with a cup, obviously? What do you do with a cup? You drink it. Why is she drinking it? Because she's enjoying this. All right. Whatever this cup is and those abominations, which we'll see, she's enjoying this. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery. Now, we've seen the idea of things being stamped on their foreheads all throughout the book. God's 144,000 were each sealed on their forehead with God's mark. The beast will insist that all who worship him have his mark on their head. This woman has a mark on her head, too, that identifies who she is. And the name on her head says, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Well, that tells us something about her. The mother's begins things. We just celebrated Mother's Day not that long ago. Adam called Eve. Her name Eve, because it means the mother of all living, the progenitor, the beginner, the starter. Well, if she's the start, she's the beginning, she's the thing that produced all of earth's prostitutes and earth's abominations, then she represents what started it, which we also said Babylon, the Tower of Babel, is where this all began. Earth's rebellion in the form of idolatry. This woman represents false religion. She represents idolatry in all of its forms. In fact, those terms abominations are frequently used in the Old Testament to reference different false gods. 1 Kings chapter 11. I'm going to turn there really quickly and read this with you because this is a description of Solomon, the wise king of Israel. Of course, we know what Solomon's major weakness and trouble was that he allowed himself to fall prey to many idolatrous women. So 1 Kings 11, verses 5 through 7. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and of the Ammonites on the mountains east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. Did you notice what it called Chemosh? He's an abomination. Why is he an abomination? Because he's a false god. He's not the true God. That little statue they built in no way represents what God really is. And so the scriptures call them abominations. So when this woman's holding this cup full of abominations and she's called the mother of earth's abominations, she represents the fullness, the beginning, and everything that follows of all of earth's false worship. All of our idolatry that we've come up with, and every nation in the history of the world has had its own God that it has followed. Even Israel, God's chosen people so often fell into the clutches of idolatry that God kicked them out of the land because they refused to stay faithful to what he said in his commandments. I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The reformers did a great job of explaining what that means for us, because having no other gods before me does not mean don't have any gods ahead of me, but you can have gods behind me, that's okay. It means you will have no other gods in my presence. There will be no false gods in God's kingdom, is what it was supposed to be. And here's Solomon, the man who most in history represented the peace and glory of the kingdom that God is going to bring to his people, polluted that kingdom with false worship, building temples for the gods that his wives would worship. And that led all of Israel astray so that they worshiped the abominations of the nations around them. This woman represents that. She represents idolatry in all of its forms. There's something else about her, though. In verse 6, John says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. It's just another historical fact that John is referencing here, that every nation that has had false worship has also persecuted those who refuse to follow along with it. It is the nature of sin. It does not tolerate dissent. It doesn't tolerate the truth. And so when God's people, living in the midst of that society, whatever society it is, refuse to follow along in the worship of false gods, they're persecuted. And Jesus told us that. All who seek to live godly will suffer persecution. See that happening a bit today, don't we? For all the talk of tolerance, all the talk of having a diverse society, what seems to be the one viewpoint that's not tolerated? God's viewpoint. Why is that? It's just simple, basic. It's basic. I don't even know what the word is here. Basic science, it's basic truth. Truth cannot exist alongside the lie. It can't work. They cannot exist and cooperate. Light can't exist with darkness. You cannot have two parallel societies working together that are so completely opposed. And so one will seek to destroy the other. And we serve the kingdom of light, and so what day do we wait for darkness to be destroyed? Is that our job now? No. We wait for Christ to come. We wait for him to conquer. That doesn't mean we don't advocate for righteous things. I'm not saying that. We do. We should stand up for laws that are good and just. But we're not seeking the eradication of evil. We know Christ will do that when he comes back. So this woman's drunk with the blood of the saints. She's bloodthirsty. She wants to see God's people destroyed. And that has happened in all of the idolatrous nations in which God's people have found themselves. Egypt tried to destroy the firstborn of the Israelites. The Assyrians slaughtered Israelites by the thousands when they conquered. Babylon sought to destroy any who wouldn't bow before her own gods, and so Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and others were thrown into things like the fiery furnace, or they were killed. Rome threw Christians to the lions, made them fight gladiators. Nero used Christians dipped in tar as torches to light his garden parties. So sadistic has been the persecution of God's people throughout history. So she's drunk with the blood of the saints because the idolatry and idolatrous practices always persecute God's people. When I saw her, end of verse 6, I marveled greatly. He's marveling at her, notice. He's not marveling at the beast. Why? Because the beast has already been explained. We had another parenthesis in the narrative of Revelation back in chapters 12, 13, and 14, that explained the beast. It explained what this thing represents. And so he doesn't marvel at the beast. He marvels at the idea that this woman's riding on the beast and what that means. And so that's going to have to be explained to him. So just a very quick recap of what the beast is. We saw him before, a scarlet beast with seven heads and 10 horns. Those heads each represent kingdoms. In fact, the angel is going to explain this to us in just a little bit. Okay, verse 9. Jump ahead a little bit to verse 9. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. So the seven heads of this beast, we're told what they are. They're kings. And we can expand that as a king is the head of a kingdom. Seven kingdoms are represented by this beast. Seven kingdoms of world history that have influenced the people of God. Starting way back in ancient Egypt, the first world empire to have dominion over God's people, the Jews. Egypt. The next major world empire were the Assyrians. That's number two. After the Assyrians came the Babylonians. The Babylonians were conquered by the Persians. The Persians were conquered by Alexander the Great and the Greeks. The Greeks maintained control over God's people in Israel with a brief little hiatus of the Hasmonean dynasty of Jewish kings. If you've ever read the book of Maccabees, there's a brief period where the Jews regained their own independence and ruled as a nation. But then they were conquered by the Romans. So these kingdoms are representative of these heads are representative of these kingdoms that have had dominion over the people of Israel. The angel tells us five of whom have fallen. So what period of time is the angel telling John this? When was the book of Revelation written? Close to the end of the first century. We're talking 95 AD, sometime around there. So by that point in history, when the angel says this, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece have all risen and fallen. Five have been, and he says this. Five of whom have fallen. One is. So who was the ruling world empire when John writes the book of Revelation? Rome. One is. One is yet to come. The seventh head, even in John's day, had not yet arisen, and in our day it has not yet arisen. We're looking forward to one more major world empire. Sometimes we hear talk in biblical prophecy about a coming world empire, and that's because of references like this. We see some of those influences at work today pushing us to dismantle borders and everybody work together. We want one more. We want to rule as a world rather than as individual countries. And that's all part of what is working towards this final world empire. There will be one more. Daniel described it as a great, fearsome beast unlike the others because it tramples everything in pieces. Because the last world empire is going to be like the previous world empires, but bigger, stronger, more fearsome in its expression. Now, the angel also told us, so five have fallen, one is, that's Rome, one has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. Why is it only a little while? Because it's only 7 years. The final world empire comes to power after the rapture of the church. It enthrones Antichrist as its king, and then it only lasts for 7 years. Now, that's pretty short in the span of world empires. Most of them have lasted for centuries. But this final world empire will only last a little while. Now, verse 11, he continues the interpretation of the beast for us. As for the beast, now we're talking about the whole monster. He was just talking about the individual heads. So now the whole thing, the beast. As for the beast that was and is not, it's an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. The Antichrist is the beast. He stands at the head of these seven world empires as the culmination of everything they were trying to do. Every one of those world empires had the same goal. They wanted to unite all of humanity under their rule. They couldn't do it fully because it wasn't God's time. Antichrist will, and he will unite the entire world under one rule, under one head, and it will be him. We've talked about Antichrist. He is demonic. He arises out of the abyss back in the sixth trumpet judgment. Revelation chapter 9 says that one of the trumpet judgments, God opens the abyss and out come this swarm of locusts, which are these demonic creatures. And for 5 months, they torment the world by stinging people with their tails and breathing fire on them. And they have as a king over them, the king of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon. In the Greek, it's Apollyon. He is the angel of the abyss. He's the beast. He's the Antichrist. He's going to be the head of this final world empire. And there's a reason that the world will follow him, which he continues to explain here. I know I've left a little bit because... Oh, go back to verse 8. That's what I forgot. Back to verse 8. So the angel's saying, don't marvel. I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with the seven heads and 10 horns. And so he hasn't explained the woman yet. He's still explaining the beast. Seven heads are the seven previous world empires, or the seven world empires. But he says something here in this verse about the beast that's really interesting. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and to go to destruction. What does he mean by that? How can something be and not be and will be? Well, I think this is a reference to the fact that the beast, as a demonic figure, was loose on the world at some point. At some point, he was imprisoned in the abyss, because that's where we see him released from in Revelation chapter 9. He's the king of the angel. He's the angel of the abyss. He's the king over those demonic locusts. His name is Abaddon, Apollyon, but he's released for a time from prison in the abyss. That's why he is currently not. When the angel writes this, he's still imprisoned. As we read this, he's still imprisoned, and he won't be released until God opens the shaft of that abyss in Revelation chapter 9. And so, why was he? He was because he was an angel created by God, but he fell into sin along with Satan and his rebellion. And for some reason that we are not explained, he was imprisoned. He and other angels with him were imprisoned in the abyss, and that's where they are now for a time. So he is not. He was, he is not, but he will rise out of the abyss because God will release him. And so, this head of the final world empire is going to be a demonic figure. Notice how the world responds to this. Well, I should note, first of all, there's a little phrase there in verse 8. He rises from the bottomless pit, but where is he going? He's going to destruction. He thinks he gets out. And there's this big question in our minds and in theology. How much do the demons know about what's going to happen? Do they really think they can win? I mean, are they that deceived that they think they can beat God, actually? Or do they know the end is coming, and they're just trying to take out as many people with them as they can? It's a fun question. I mean, you're trying to delve into the mind and the workings of a demon's mind, which don't go too far down that road, by the way. Certainly don't try to ask them. Whatever it is, he's not going back to the abyss. He's not going back into chains in the abyss. When Christ returns, one of the statements that's made is that the beast and the dragon and the false prophet, not the dragon, I'm sorry, the beast and the false prophet were immediately thrown into the lake of fire, which is the eternal place of torment. It's the second death. They don't go back to the abyss for a temporary restraining like Satan does. They go to destruction. They go to the lake of fire. They go to eternal torment. That's eternal destruction, by the way. It's not like, poof, they're gone. It says the smoke of their torment will ascend up into heaven forever and ever. So he was, he is not, because he's imprisoned in the abyss. He's about to rise from the bottomless pit when God releases him during the end time, but he's going to go to destruction. And look at how the world responds to this. The dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. Here's how the world responds to him. The very fact that they recognize in him that he rose out of the abyss is going to be part of what draws the world to them. Now, I'm surmising here. I'm just surmising. I want you to know that, because the scripture doesn't clearly state this extrapolation from that. My surmising is that one of the things the beast is going to do is say, look, I got out of prison. We can stop God. Follow me, and we'll be able to stop him. See, I got out. I escaped his judgment. You can escape his judgment, too, if you just follow me. And the world marvels at him. Now, whether that's the actual what's going to happen, I don't know. You know, Tim LaHaye has some other ideas about how that's going to happen. By the way, draw your theology from the Bible a lot more than from popular novels, okay? The Antichrist probably is not going to come from Romania. I'm not sure why he picked that country. I shouldn't comment too much. I never actually read the books. Anybody read the books? No? Okay. Left Behind, the whole series Left Behind. Yeah, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins wrote. This is what Scripture actually does tell us. The world's going to marvel after the beast. They're going to follow him. They're very willingly going to follow his plan, whatever it is. So verse 9 and following, we've already talked about. The angel explains, okay, that's the beast, that's the Antichrist. He arises out of the abyss. He's the head of this final world empire that is the seventh of a series of world empires. That's the heads. So jump down to verse 12, and he starts explaining the ten horns. We've already explained the seven heads. The ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. So what's the seventh world empire going to look like? Somehow it includes these ten kings. That final expression of a one-world empire is going to have ten kings setting over it. It says they receive authority for 1 hour, but they will hand over their power and authority to the beast. They're going to willingly grant him the headship over that final world empire. Well, I think seven of them are going to willingly do it. Daniel sees a vision where the ten horns, another strong horn comes up in the midst of them and plucks up three of the horns. And so three of these kings are going to be defeated by Antichrist. The rest of them are willingly going to hand over their power, probably so that they don't get destroyed. And that's going to set the Antichrist as the ruler of the whole world with these kings underneath of him. And that's how he comes to power. That's going to be the final form of the last world empire. That's why they hand over their authority for 1 hour, or together with the beast. Verse 13, these are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. Verse 14, they will make war on the Lamb. Here's kind of the total point of Antichrist's kingdom is to make war on the Lamb. World, we can stop Christ from returning. We can fight him off. We can keep him from taking over this world. But notice what the result of this is going to be. The Lamb will conquer them. You don't normally picture a lamb as a warrior. And yet he is. He's the conquering Lamb. For he is Lord of lords, he is King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. Not only is he Lord of lords and King of kings, but his army that comes with him is a righteous army. That's us. Clothed in the righteousness of Christ, we accompany him on this conquering mission to defeat Antichrist and the rebellious world. We're going to see a picture of that in chapter 19 and 20. The angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So over whom does this woman have authority? All of it. That picture of being seated on the sea of humanity. It's kind of this is what the woman influences. She has influenced everything. Not a nation has arisen on the face of this earth that hasn't been somewhat influenced by this woman, this prostitute, influenced by idolatry, by false worship. The ten horns that you saw, they and the beast, and here's where things really start to get interesting, right? Because we look at world history and say, goodness, every major empire in the history of the world has been idolatrous in one way or another. But look at what happens here at the end. And even she's sitting on the beast, so the beginning of his kingdom is going to be idolatrous. Probably when the beast takes authority, the world is going to be a very pluralistic place. You worship whatever God you want. You're just going to allow everybody to worship. As long as you don't worship the true God, you're okay. We'll let you worship. Mankind loves that because mankind loves the sin that comes with it. You realize every form of false worship actually ends or begins because of a love of sin. Look at the gods of the ancient world. Every one of them had some sort of heinous activity attached to them. Think of Bacchus, the god of drunkenness and wine. Well, why would you worship him? Oh, because I love being drunk. I love alcohol. I love the control. I love the feel. And so I'm going to worship Bacchus because that's what he gives me. Worship Mars, the god of war. Why? Because you love death and bloodshed. You love war. You love vengeance. So I'm going to worship a god that will give me those things. Go to the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, where Paul tries to plant one of the early churches. And what was the worship of Artemis? It was vile. It was a place of unrestrained sexual expression. Anything you wanted to do was available at the Temple of Artemis because she was the goddess of fertility. And that was what worship was like. Why? Because the man, heart of man, sinful beyond measure, craves to express its sinfulness. And in worshiping false gods, it gives itself sort of a sanctification of that sin. It says that sin's actually holy. That sin is spiritual. Well, what happens when we come to the worship of the true God? What does he tell us? Sin can't even come into his presence. We must be made pure. We must have a sacrifice to cover our sin. And that's Christ. We come because we want to become like our God, holy. We crave it. In Christ, we long to be righteous. He's enlivened us in that way so that we want to be holy. But in this part of world history, mankind is going to be even more unrestrained than they currently are in their pursuit of spiritual abomination. And so imagine what the horror of the world will look like at that point. But something interesting happens then, verse 16. The ten horns that you saw, those two ten kings that rule over that final kingdom, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. Now this kind of makes sense, because we know in the middle of the tribulation period, the beast steps into the temple in Jerusalem and says, I am God. I'm God on earth. You will all bow and worship me. Well, you can't have a pluralistic multi-religious society if you're going to make that kind of a claim. And so this is where the pluralism of the final world empire ends. And the beast stops tolerating the rampant idolatry of the world and directs it all towards himself. So they hate the woman. They make her desolate and naked. They devour her flesh. They burn her up with fire. They destroy the idolatrous practices of the world so that the world will unite in its worship of the Antichrist. There won't be any more toleration and diversity. It'll all be directed towards him, and the demand will be you worship Antichrist or you die. And by the way, folks, persecution throughout the history of the world has rarely taken the form where just because you're a Christian, I'm going to kill you. Usually it has some kind of political or religious overtone. Even Nebuchadnezzar throwing those men in the fiery furnace wasn't just because they were Jewish, but it was because their faith in Jehovah God made them refuse to accept Nebuchadnezzar as a god himself. In the Roman world, Christians were allowed to be Christians until they refused to call Caesar Lord. So same thing today. They're going to persecute believers. They're never going to say, well, it's because you're Christians. In fact, they're going to go out of their way to say, no, we love Christians. We love everybody. Only if your Christianity really influences you. Only if it makes you refuse to bow to the greater religion, whatever is being pushed at the moment. We have to be able to discern those things and understand, where does Christ lead us? What is he going to tell us we cannot do? And who do we hold in higher authority, even than the state? Well, why do they burn her up with fire? Verse 17, God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Why is the world going to unite around Antichrist? Because this is God's plan. God's put it into their hearts to ravish the woman, to destroy idolatry from the earth and worship the beast, because God is leading world history to that point. Why? So that he can send his son to conquer it. So that the world can be in the fullness of its rebellious expression. So that sin can come to full fruition. And Christ still conquers it. So that the world can be in the strongest expression of sinful rebellion that it possibly could be, and still Christ wins. And so God is never out of control of these events. He's always the one making sure it goes where it's supposed to go. Don't ever forget that. The book of Daniel reemphasizes this same point over and over again. Even in the midst of a wicked, corrupt government like Babylon, the message of the book of Daniel was, who rules in the kingdoms of men? The Most High. He's bigger than Nebuchadnezzar. He's bigger than Marduk. He's bigger than Chemosh. He's bigger than any other god, because he alone is the true God, and he rules over the kingdoms of men. Our God is never out of control of events. Never. All things are working according to the counsel of his own will. We can take a lot of confidence in that. And so in the end times, that's going to be God allowing the world to coalesce around the Antichrist so that Christ can conquer. Verse 18, he finishes up his explanation of who this is. The woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Now, what city is that? That's her name, Babylon. Babylon has been a moving force throughout history because of the influence of idolatry and the influence of false religion. And she continues to be an influence in the history of our world, even though the city itself has long since been laid in ruins. Probably, based on some of the other prophecies that we see in the Old Testament, Babylon's going to be rebuilt during this final period of history. And the Antichrist has some purpose for Babylon, whether as kind of like a religious capital of the world to rival Jerusalem, or whether it's going to be the commercial capital, whatever it is, Babylon's got a major part to play in the end times events as a city once again, until it is finally destroyed by Christ's return, which is what he will turn his attention to in chapters 18, the destruction of Babylon. But before he gets to that, we needed to understand what Babylon has to do with this unfolding of events. Why is Babylon fallen? Why is that such an important message? Why is it so important to remember that God has remembered Babylon the Great to make her drink the wine of the wrath of his fury? Because Babylon's been the influence in the world for a very, very, very long time, moving men to rebellion against God. All the way back from that first thing, scatter and fill the earth, and they said, no, we won't. And that rebellion, it's kind of this picture of this woman. Well, I want you to go out from here, not just understanding some of these images a little better, but being strengthened in an understanding, especially because of that verse we read about God's put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose. All of these things are going to work out because it's God's purpose. He is not out of control. He's not out of control now. He won't be out of control then. He'll never be out of control. So don't worry. Don't be anxious when you read the news. Maybe don't read the news. I wrestle with that. Yeah, I mean, you guys know I like to try to stay up on current events, but it's frustrating, isn't it? It's frustrating. I think sometimes I go and think, maybe I'll just get one little shred of good news. No, it doesn't happen. So, but who's in control? So can we still be strong? We still have a mission to accomplish, preach the gospel. We still have a purpose, bring glory to God while we're here. And we need to continue to be strong in accomplishing that. So let's stand together as we close our time here. We're going to sing out, "Be strong in the Lord. And be of good courage. Your mighty defender is always the same."